From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, comic and actor Artie Lang of The Howard Stern Show. He's become famous for his self-deprecating stories about drinking, overeating, gambling, and women. This weekend, Lang hosts Friday Night Stand-Up on Comedy Central, and his movie Beer League will have its network premiere there. Also, we remember writer Grace Paley and listen back to her 1985 interview. Paley died Wednesday at the age of 84. And film critic David Edelstein reviews The Nanny Diaries, based on the best-selling novel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today we start the show with Terry's 2006 interview with Artie Lang of The Howard Stern Show. Lang is hosting the Friday night stand-up marathon tonight on Comedy Central, a marathon that also includes the network's premiere of Beer League, the movie he co-wrote and in which he stars. Since joining The Howard Stern Show in 2001, Artie Lang has become famous for his self-deprecating stories, which are usually about his drinking, overeating, gambling, and his on-again, off-again relationship with his girlfriend. At this point, it's definitely off. Artie was an original cast member of the Fox sketch comedy series Mad TV, and was a regular on the ABC sitcom Norm. He's appeared in the films Dirty Work, The Bachelor, Old School, and Elf. His movie Beer League is about a group of guys in New Jersey whose softball team is in the league playoffs. For them, softball is more about drinking beer and goofing off than playing ball. Terry spoke with Artie Lang last year.
How close is the character you play in Beer League to you?
Too close. This would be me if I didn't get lucky and get into show business. I would be exactly this guy. Unfortunately, I'd be, you know, by the time I was this age, probably a raging alcoholic, playing in a softball league that I took way too seriously, and probably living with my mother. That sounds like an accurate description.
Tell me a story from the movie that actually comes from your real life.
You know, these leagues are all, they call them beer leagues. They should really call them hard liquor leagues. The drinking is just such a part of the softball culture. Before, sometimes during, and after a game, I played in a league where every base was a quarter keg of beer, and you had a cup in your back pocket. If you got on base, you filled up. And I don't know who in the town committee allowed this to happen, but within 2 weeks, they had to, get rid of the league because people were just drunk by the second inning, throwing bats, and it was violent. And the fight in the film, in particular, the old guy on our team, played by Seymour Cassell, he has a line in the movie where he tells the one kid to hold another guy's head while he tries to kick him. That really happened. I played in a league where a guy who was about 78 years old, who was our pitcher, and a brawl busted out, and he told my friend on our team to hold the kid's head while he tried to kick him, and he went to kick him, and he grabbed his gut, and he fell down. We thought he had a heart attack. So it's basically the fight in the movie is based on several different fights that actually happened.
Now, the first time you were on Howard Stern's show was as a guest with Norm Macdonald. You and he were promoting a movie.
Right.
You were really funny on it. How did you go from being a guest to being part of the regular cast of characters?
Well, that appearance was to promote a film called Dirty Work. And Norm knew how big of a fan of the Stern show I was. He was going in to promote the film. He said, hey, why don't you come with me and maybe, you know, Howard will have you on. And Norm at the time was going through kind of a crazy separation, sort of divorce, and he didn't want to deal with that. And Howard, you know, always asked those personal questions. So Norm said, hey, if that happens, I'll bring you in and we'll talk about the movie. So sure enough, a minute into Norm's interview, that happened, and they bring me in, and as they're putting the headset on me, Norm says to Howard on the air, and I did not know he was going to do this, he said, Howard, you'll love Artie. He got kicked off of Mad TV because of cocaine. And I on the air, I just, like, looked at him like, what the hell did you just say? And Howard, of course, darted his eyes right to me. And I told this whole story about getting arrested and almost getting fired and going to rehab. And, of course, Howard loved that. He loves stories like that. So he said to Norm, bring Artie back when you come back, and we'll hear more stories like that. We went back in three more times to promote a sitcom we were doing together called Norm. And every time I went in, I would tell another crazy story, and Howard always loved it. And when the Norm show got canceled, it was, again, one of those things in life, perfect timing. It was a coincidence. Jackie Martling, the comedian who was on the show for years, left the show, and they were looking for another guy. So Howard remembered me from going in with Norm several times. And 2 months later, they whittled it down to a couple of guys, and then eventually I got offered the job.
Now, you know how you're saying Norm Macdonald brought you on because he didn't want to answer the personal questions that he knew Howard would ask?
Right.
You're asked those questions all the time. Yeah. I mean, it's just anything about, you know, drugs, sex, your right. girlfriend or your ex-girlfriend, depending on what day it is.
Yeah, exactly.
Were you ready for that? Are you comfortable with that? Are there ever kind of consequences?
Yes, absolutely. It's my fault. Before anybody takes the blame for that, I would have to. I offered it up from the very beginning. I was always sort of honest about my life and the bad parts as well as the good parts. And now, you know, I'm just known for being so honest that it's almost expected of me to just come clean and say everything. There are lines I won't cross. Dating someone, that's a fine sort of that's a difficult road to go down. And I found the boundaries as we went along. There's a story about a hooker that ripped me off in Las Vegas for $500 that I told him off the air. And on the air, he just brought it up. And he said, come on, tell the story. And he ended up getting it out of me. It happened before I was dating my girlfriend. But we were dating at the time he got me to tell the story. So it was a very sensitive thing. She was like, I can't believe you told that story. And I said, well, it was before you. She goes, yeah, but it's still embarrassing. And so stuff like that has happened.
Now, listeners know that your girlfriend or now ex-girlfriend?
Right now, unfortunately, it's ex-girlfriend, yes.
Yeah, well, she had always wanted you to go into therapy. You right. got a lot of issues.
Definitely.
Gambling, drugs, alcohol, food, other things.
Every commitment. Self-destructive thing, yeah.
Yeah. So she wanted you to go into therapy. You've always avoided therapy. Now, my producer, Amy, pointed out that being on Howard's show is almost like therapy in the sense that you're always talking about yourself, telling stories about yourself.
Yes.
And Howard's always like forcing you to go deeper and deeper. But then my producer Phyllis pointed out that although the talk part might sound like therapy, therapy expects you to change. But on Howard's show, it's kind of like you're rewarded for that kind of behavior because
absolutely.
If you can get a good story out of it, that's all anybody wants.
Yeah, no, that's very perceptive of both of them, actually. You know, it's weird. A lot of comics, actually Andrew Dice Clay, who I met through the show and worked with once, would say, what do you want to go to therapy for? You, the fact that you're so screwed up in the head is why you're funny. You know, why would you want to fix that? And in a way, it makes sense. I guess all comics, at least the most of them that I know, could probably use a good dose of therapy. And a lot of them are reluctant. Because they feel in some way maybe it'll lose their edge and their crazy view of life and why they're funny. And that sounds a little ridiculous to me, but maybe deep down I really do feel that way.
One of your most famous stories from the Howard Stern Show is back when you were a regular on Mad TV, the sketch comedy
right.
show, and you were doing a lot of cocaine at the time. And you were very high and totally lacking in sleep. I think it had been like 4 days without sleep at
yes.
this point. So the story, it's a really long and very funny kind of tragic story.
Yeah.
About how you ended up punching one of the producers and then fleeing from the cops because they had called the cops on you.
Right.
Fleeing from the cops and then you end up punching one of the cops and he finds cocaine on you, so you're
yes.
arrested for assaulting an officer and possessing cocaine. Okay, great story. People on Howard Stern really loved it. What's it like when you're working with Howard and Robin and say you don't show up? Say I don't know if you're still getting high, or whatever, but say something not quite as out of control like that happens in the context of their show. Do they think it's so funny?
Well, first of all, no, I stopped doing cocaine. I had to. The last time I did coke and from going to rehab, everybody remembers dates. June the 14th, 1997 is the last hit of blow I did, thank God, because that was just killing me. I still drink, and a lot of people say, well, how can you do one without the other? I've been able to do it, thank God. And look, I've had coke put in my hand on the road at gigs, and I'm able to just throw it away. I just look at it like death, the devil, But last year, I had a lot of stress. I was traveling to promote a DVD and my stand-up comedy, and I did 6 months on the road while I was doing the show at the same time, weekend gigs, and then I was going into shooting this film, Beer League, and I was really, really stressed, and I was drinking a lot on the road. And when I got back from Chicago last June, the week after the gig, in between the road and shooting the movie, I sort of had a breakdown to where I couldn't get to work, and I've suffered through depressions, and I think it all stems from addictions. I think my depression was caused by the drugs I was using way back when, and I think the alcohol that I was consuming on the road and just the stress of traveling and the strain caused me to go into this depression. I couldn't. When I go into these depressions, it's insane. I like people say, I get depressed sometimes too, but it's a different kind of thing. And anyone who suffered from this will know what I'm talking about. It just stays on you like a wet blanket. You physically can't move. You're so out of it. You can't function. You can't shave. And like I went through one of these episodes, last year, and I couldn't make it to the show for 4 days. Now, it was way more amplified publicly at this point because I'm more famous now, and the Stern Show is obviously a high-profile thing. And in the context of the show, he just made a joke about it. You know, it's just it's a tragic thing, I guess. But, you know, it's a comedy show, and a lot of the material is dark, and it's based on our real life. So when I got back after missing 4 days, I got teased and reamed and everything else by the callers, by him, and I never stopped it. I just took it because if you take it, you're able to also dish it out. And I wanted to prove to myself that I had a thick skin and could deal with it. So I dealt with it, and after a few days, it went away. If I had told him, look, this is a serious issue, and we shouldn't really handle it this way on the air, believe me, he would respect that. That's how he is. But I never did that. I said, to hell with it. I'm going to go in and fess up to what happened and just deal with it. And that's what I did. And eventually it went away, you know.
Well, getting back to that similarity between being on the show and being in therapy, although you're not in therapy, when you go through a really bad depression like that, and then right. You come on the show and everybody's kind of ribbing you for it, and you're talking about it, and they're talking about it, and the callers right. are talking about it.
Yeah,
what does it help or hurt in terms of your own emotional inner life?
I don't know. You see, I created a sort of a monster on the show with this bit that I do, where I go like this: if somebody's complaining about something, I'll say, wah, I do this thing where, you know, the yeah. whining wah thing. And that became a bit that I did for like a year on the show. And then, of course, as soon as I got back, the first caller hits me with, wah, I'm depressed, wah, wah, I got to make a movie and I'm stressed out, wah. So, and on the I mean, I have created, God forbid, if I ever died, some of these crazy fans would show up to my wake and go up to my mother and go, wah, my fat son died, wah. they're that nuts. So, look, I sat there and I said to myself, I dish it out and I got to take this. And I'm doing okay now. Maybe it helped, but I don't know. I have never really figured out in a really deep, sort of thorough way what causes that in my head. I mean, obviously, therapy would...
I was going to point that out.
Therapy would help that, but I'm still reluctant to go, and the only therapy I get is on national radio. So maybe I'm a human experiment. We'll see if it's working or not.
Artie Lang speaking to Terry Gross last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Artie Lang of The Howard Stern Show. He's the guest host for tonight's lineup on Comedy Central, which includes a late-night showing of his own movie, Beer League.
What are the preparations like for the show?
The lack of preparation early in the morning. I always thought that, you know, Howard got there at like a quarter to five and got bits together and you know, every newspaper article he wanted to talk about was out. And he gets a lot of that done at home through the use of a computer now with everybody. And like the first time I showed up, I got there at 20 to 6, and I'm sitting there. I wanted to make sure I was early. I'm like, where's Howard? Where's Howard? He walked in at like 3 minutes to 6, said hi to me. Gary went over a couple of minor things with him, and he went right on the air. So I got used to that. The preparation for me is, I mean, I have the dream job. I have no preparation. Like, all my work is what you hear me say on the air. I'll try to read the New York Post, page 6, because that's probably the part of a newspaper that he'll refer to the most, so I'll try to get familiar with that real quick in the morning over a cup of coffee. And then I like it this way because it sounds more conversational. I genuinely have no idea what he's going to bring up, and my job is just to roll with the punches, whatever the subject is, and try to add humor to it. And it's been working so far. I like the spontaneity. I don't like to be overly prepared for anything.
Let me ask you something about the show that I just want your impression of this. Sometimes I think that some of the more like homophobic humor mm-hmm. on the show and misogynist humor on the show, it's like when you're doing it on the show, I could see you guys are really funny. And even when things rub me the wrong way,
right.
You're pros. You're good at what you do. You're all brilliant at what you do. But then I wonder about the people listening who, you know, if they think like, hey, it's really cool to be homophobic, or it's right. like really cool to just have girls who are strippers and to think of all girls as strippers. Do you worry about that at all?
Yes, to a certain extent. I'd be lying if I said I don't worry about it. But to me, the people you're describing are dumb people, you know. The Howard Stern Show is a big hit because it entertains dumb and smart people at the same time for different reasons. And there's a couple of shows like that. The Simpsons is another one. Smart people and stupid people love The Simpsons for totally different reasons. That's why it's a big hit. Everybody's either smart or stupid, so a lot of people watch it.
Yeah.
Our show, smart people and stupid people love it for different reasons. And early on in my career, I sort of just made a commitment to myself. I refuse to cater to stupid people. What we do on the air is just try to be funny and hope that the smart people listen more than the dumb people.
How do you feel about the part of the show where people become regulars because of a physical deformity, like a mental problem?
Right.
You're comfortable with that part?
You know, again, there's times where it's heartbreaking to see some of the people come in and get on the air and speak about their lives. This is a very difficult subject because the one argument is you're giving some sort of wonderful gift to these people that they're becoming sort of mini celebrities. Like
right.
Beetlejuice is an example of a guy. He's a a retarded black midget who you know, drinks all the time, and he's got bad teeth, and the guy's a rock star. He makes over six figures a year doing appearances because the show made him famous. And I really think he's having a good time with it. You know, he seems happy. He seems to like the attention and all the party and everything, whereas without that, his life would be, you know, lonely and pathetic and everything. Now, that's me sort of justifying what we do. You know, that's the positive argument. He could go home and have really, really dark, dark times thinking about, they're laughing at me and I'm being exploited and, he gets paid a lot of money and there's people that handle him. They seem to be good, honest people, and I hope that they take care of him. But look, we don't see him 24 hours a day. He seems to be fine with it. But if I knew that one of these people that comes on our show all the time was really hurting about it and felt exploited and was sad, to be honest with you, that would really make me upset. And I would question having them on again if that were the case. I genuinely think that the people that come on our show enjoy it, enjoy the attention, and I think it enriches their lives. That would have been, you know, really, really maybe boring, mundane, and, you know, for lack of a better word, horrible without all this love. They get a lot of love. You know, Beetlejuice, again, is a guy who was born with this deformity, but when he walks on stage, he gets all that affection. They love him. It's like Elvis, mm-hmm. and I genuinely think he digs it. If I thought he didn't, it would bug me. It really would. And I'd have to be honest about that. I go, look, this kid's miserable doing this. We shouldn't, you know, have him on anymore.
Artie Lang speaking to Terry Gross. We'll have more of their conversation in the second half of the show. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air. Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of Somerset Maugham's novel Of Human Bondage, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting health insurance coverage for all America's children, on the web at covertheuninsured.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, we remember writer Grace Paley. The Bronx neighborhood where she grew up was the inspiration for a lot of her stories. Paley died Wednesday at the age of 84. Also, David Edelstein reviews The Nanny Diaries, and we continue our interview with Artie Lang. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. We're listening back to an interview Terry conducted last year with Artie Lang of The Howard Stern Show. Tonight, he shows up on Comedy Central to host a marathon of stand-up comedy shows and to preside over a late-night showing of his own movie, Beer League.
When you were, well, I forget what year it was, but your father was a contractor. And he
installed
had an accident.
Television antennas, yeah.
He had an accident. He fell off the roof.
Yes.
And, had quadriplegia after
right.
that. How did that change your life?
Oh, God. He was my best friend. It was the quintessential father-son sort of American relationship. We played baseball together, and you know, he was everything to me. And I sort of looked at him like Superman. I mean, almost literally, I would go to him to work and I would go to work with him and he would be on the roof. And I thought he could fly when I was like 7 years old, literally. And he fell a week after my 18th birthday. And it was like, here's adulthood, like throwing cold water in your face. And it changed my life in the sense that I was a horrible student. I was never going to go to college. I just used that as an extra reason not to go. But I was definitely a lost soul. I knew I wanted to be a comedian, but that seemed like a huge mountain. How was I going to make that happen? And when he fell and we went broke, my mother, you know, he fell off a ladder that he had stolen. And he wasn't even using it properly, and he fell off a house that had no homeowner's insurance. So there's always somebody to sue, usually, so at least you get a settlement. There was nobody to sue. So we, you know, had no money saved anyway, and there were doctor bills, and my mother had to go on welfare. I remember driving my mother to the welfare office at 18, and she was a very proud Italian woman, and she hated going through that. And my father was sitting there. He couldn't move. And I used it as an excuse to just go into an insane downward spiral. I mean, every self-destructive thing you could imagine. Drinking, drugs, gambling, you know, overeating, bar fights, getting into fights with guys I knew could kick my ass, bouncers, just because I just wanted to just get in my own dark world and just, you know, sort of wallow in it and just escape. And that was my excuse. That was my why. You know, I was my old man's a quadriplegic, so I deserve to get drunk. And that's when all my addictions really kicked in. So before he fell, I really didn't have those issues. I might have been on the road to them. After he fell, they all kicked in, and I just went, it was the 4 years that he lived after the accident was, it's all a blur to me. I can barely remember it.
Did you take any responsibility for taking care of him?
Well, yeah, what happened was, because we couldn't afford 24-hour nurses, Medicaid allowed for a nurse 8 hours a day. My mother got a secretarial job, so he had to be turned every couple hours, otherwise you get bad bed sores. So, if I was home hungover or something, I would turn him and talk to him. And we had these crazy, just like one-on-one conversations when my mother was at a job as a secretary and my sister was bartending to put herself through college. And it was just me and him in the house. And he's like looking at me like, how did I do this? What happened? And it was just really dark, depressing conversations. And more than once, he asked me to kill him. And that had to be like such a hard, you know, to ask his son. He would even say stuff like, you know, he had all these crazy pills, painkillers, which I stole every once in a while to get high. And he would say, look, just leave them on the table. I'll somehow get them in my mouth. You know, like you don't have to shoot me in the head or anything. And that's literally what the conversations were like for 4 years. And I just stayed self-medicated. And I would try to turn them when my mother couldn't. And then I would go out at night and get drunk or whatever, and my mother would literally have to set her alarm for every 2 hours to get up and turn him, and then get up and go to work all day. So I took over some of his accounts, installing antennas, climbing roofs, just because we needed the money so desperately. My mother hated that, but I was capable of doing it. I had learned how to do it through him, so I started installing antennas in the first couple of years after he fell, just to get some immediate money. But of course, my mother was freaked out. Now I'm climbing a roof,
right,
you know.
Right,
so
right.
That's how I tried to help, by doing some work. But I was basically in those 4 years no help at all. It's probably why I'm so guilty now, and I try to, I lavish my mother with everything I possibly can, you know.
Your father died 4 years after the accident, and
yeah.
It was after that you started trying out comedy.
Yeah, the first time I ever tried it, I was 19 years old.
So that's when he was still alive, then.
Yes, July 12th, 1987. I'll never forget that day because that was the first I had been saying to myself, I got to try this, and I officially I got up one day, I read in the paper that the old Improv on 9th Ave and 44th Street was having a lottery. Like 200 people show up. They put 10 pieces of paper, they put a bunch of pieces of paper in a hat. If you get a piece of paper that has a number on it, that's your number that night. So first try, sure enough, on my first time going, people would go constantly and never get a number and have to come back. My first try, I got the number 10. I was 10th in a lineup of 12 guys. I had to go back that night. And I had just told my mother and father that I was going to try to do it. I took my father's handicap van into New York. I parked it on 9th Avenue. I was afraid it was going to get towed. I went into the Milford Plaza and tried out 5 minutes of stuff that I had prepared in my head, and I went up and bombed miserably. But I was proud of myself that I actually did it, you know. So I went home and told him about it, but I had bombed so bad it intimidated me, and I didn't try it again for another 4 years until after he died. So I tried it once while he was still alive, and it was a bad experience. Then I went back into the booze, wallow, and I was like, God, this dream of mine didn't work out. Now what am I going to do? I did it once, and I thought I just would always suck when everybody sucks the first time. And it took him dying for me to really go, I'm going to try this again. I'll give it one more shot. So almost in honor of his memory, I'm going to give it another shot. And it felt better that time. And out of lack of anything else to do, I just kept going back, you know.
Do you think your mother's surprised at how you turned out and how successful you are?
I think my mother in a lot of ways is surprised I'm alive, much less successful. She always had confidence in me. She was never this old-fashioned sort of Italian mother who would say, no, that's too much of a risk. Get some sort of steady work. Because I worked as, my friend got me a job as a longshoreman right after my father had passed away, unloading ships at the port in Newark. And that's a great job if you didn't go to college. You can make, you know, 80 grand a year with overtime. And I quit. I saved up a few grand, and I quit to try comedy. Now, a lot of mothers would have went, especially old-school Italian mothers, would be like, don't quit this job. It's such a great job. She was never like that. She was like, this is your dream. I believe in you. Go try it. So I think she always knew I had it in me, but the level of success I've had, maybe she didn't, you know, sort of predict that, because I've been very lucky, you know.
Well, Artie, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks. I hope this was all right. I feel like in this atmosphere, you really do even pour your heart out more than on Stern, because it's just two people. It's like a one-on-one. It really does feel like a shrink session.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
No, it's good. This
so
was,
you're going to go into therapy now?
Maybe. Maybe I'll just keep coming here every day. We could do this. Thank you very much, Terry. This was
thank you very much.
A lot of fun. Thank you.
Artie Lang of The Howard Stern Show, speaking with Terry Gross last year. You can see him and his movie Beer League tonight on Comedy Central. Coming up, another archive interview. Author and activist Grace Paley, who died this week. This is Fresh Air. Author, poet, and activist Grace Paley died this week of breast cancer. She was 84. When she was named New York's first official state writer in 1986, she said the only thing nicer might be if she got an award from her block. That's because she became famous and acclaimed for writing about the neighborhood and the everyday life of her neighbors. In the Bronx, where she was born and raised. In the Village, where she raised her family. And in Vermont, where she lived out her life with her husband, playwright Robert Nichols. Though her career as a writer spanned half a century, Paley published only 3 collections of short stories. The Little Disturbances of Man in 1959, Enormous Changes at the Last Minute in 1974, and Later the Same Day in 1985. In addition to her writing, Paley was known for her work as a women's rights and peace activist. The FBI kept a file on her in the 60s. Terry spoke with Grace Paley in 1985. Here's Paley reading an excerpt of a story from her collection, later the same day.
First, I wrote this poem. Walking up the slate path of the college park under the nearly full moon, the brown oak leaves are red as maples, and I have been looking at the young people. They speak and embrace one another. Because of them, I thought I would descend into remembering love. So I let myself down hand over hand until my feet touched the earth of the gardens of Vesey Street. I told my husband, I've just written a poem about love. What a good idea, he said. Then he told me about Sally Johnson on Lake Winnipesaukee, who was 12 and a half when he was 14. Then he told me about Rosemary Johansson on Lake Sunapee. Then he told me about Jane Marston in Concord High. Then he told me about Mary Smythe of Radcliffe when he was a poet at Harvard. Then he told me about two famous poets, one fair and one dark, both now dead, when he was a secret poet working at an acceptable trade in an office without windows. When at last he came to my time, that is, the past 15 years or so, he told me about Dottie Wasserman. Hold on, I said. What do you mean, Dottie Wasserman? She's a character in a book. She's not even a person. Okay, he said. Then why Vesey Street? What's that? Well, it's nothing special. I used to be in love with a guy who was a shrub buyer. Vesey Street was the downtown garden center of the city when the city still had wonderful centers of commerce. I used to walk the kids there when they were little carriage babies, half asleep. Maybe take the ferry to Hoboken. Years later, I'd bike down there on Sundays, ride around and around. I even saw him three times. No kidding, said my husband. How come I don't know the guy? Ugh, the stupidity of the beloved. It's you, I said. Anyway, what's this baloney about you and Dottie Wasserman?
The voices that you write with for the narrator and for the characters, I think are really like vernacular voices, and they're always so perfect. Everybody doesn't speak the same. Everybody has their own really distinctive way of speaking. It's very, for some of them, it's very ethnic. For others, it's very urban. You grew up in the Bronx in the 1920s. Can you describe what your neighborhood was like?
Well, every week somebody's furniture was on the street. I mean, that's my first memories of my block, is that all of this people were evicted. Well, every day, and you'd see this pile of furniture out there covered with newspapers and covered with tarpaulin, and that, it was mostly it was practically entirely Jewish, and people there came from Eastern Europe, Poland and Russia, mostly. And in our house, the languages that were spoken were Russian, Yiddish, and English.
Did you speak
all
of those?
And they were spoken in equal parts. Well, I never spoke either Yiddish or Russian well, but I always understood it very well, and spoke it to my grandmother, because she never got English.
Were there real talkers in your family or in the neighborhood who you would listen to and whose speech you think really affects you now in your writing?
Well, my father was a great talker. My mother was very quiet, and I think probably because my father was such a great talker, but he really was a good storyteller. And very smart and very funny. And my mother was very serious and quite different, but very straightforward and very honorable person. And in the neighborhood, the people talked all the time. And people sat outside in the street, you know. The street life was very exciting, and you couldn't get me some summer nights. Since I was the youngest by a lot, I was also overprotected and also neglected at the same time. Like I'd have to wear long stockings, you know, into the end of April. But on the other hand, they'd kind of forget that I was still outside at 11 o'clock at night on a summer night. So I had that kind of happy mixture. But the street was full of people, and it was a great. I think all writers are people who get in the habit, who love to listen, who listen a lot. So that one of the stories in this book is called The Story Hearer, and it's really what every storyteller has to be.
Were there stories that would get told to you over and over again, or was it not that kind of storytelling? Was it just like more like gossip in the street that people would talk about?
Well, first of all, I have a lot of regard for gossip. I regard it as the last great oral tradition, and the reason it's called gossip is that women do it, so that therefore it's kind of denigrated for that reason. But I, so that those were stories to me, you know, that people told about their life. What happened to you yesterday? You know, that kind of story. What happened? Oh, you know. So he came home then, did he? Yeah, you know, and all of that kind of thing. And then the stories of my family at home were always telling what had happened and. First in Europe and then here, and there was a lot to hear and a lot to listen to. And you listen because you think, oh, this is going to be my life. This is my life. I'm hearing my future. I'm hearing what I'm about.
When you started writing, did you go through a period of wanting to get the neighborhood out of your voice?
Oh, no. See, when I wrote stories, I was what I was, you know, and I never felt like wanting to get to change my language in my own speech. I remember when we were going to school, and there was something that I used to call Hunter College English, and I swore to God I'd never talk like that, if no matter what happened. You know, it seemed like a theft of my language, of my New Yorkese, and it bothered me, and there was a lot of the older people, a little bit older than I, were in my sister and brothers, among my sister and brothers' friends, really had begun to talk like that. And also, I don't think people realize this, but during the Depression or after the Depression, the only jobs people began to go into were teaching. Women could go into teaching. Well, the exams they gave in New York for teachers, and that included my sister and many of her friends and my sister-in-law, the exams they gave were very strict orals. So those orals were really designed at that time, although it seems now that three-quarters of the teachers in the city of New York say are Jewish. It seems like that, whether it's true or not. At that time, those exams were designed to keep immigrants out. And so people were going around like crazy, trying to talk American, you know, and taking classes in it. And that was what used to drive me mad. I mean, I would just say, oh, you're all talking Hunter College English.
You didn't start writing short stories until you were in your 30s. Why weren't you writing short stories before? It just seemed such the natural form for you.
Well, I thought my natural form was poetry. It's easy to say that now, but I thought of myself as a poet, or I never thought of myself as a poet. I always thought of myself as a poem writer, but in my 30s, the poems couldn't serve me. I mean, for what I wanted to do and for what I was thinking about, and of course, what I was really thinking about, and what was pressuring me in my life, which is where things come from. Really is something about women and men and how we lived, how we were not living together well on this earth, and how, and also, by then I'd had a couple kids and I'd gotten much closer to women and thought a lot about women's lives and was very interested in them, and that's what I wanted to understand. I mean, you come to writing, not from what you know, but from what you come to it with what you don't know. And that's what presses you to go on.
How much did you want your political views and your political activism to enter into your stories?
Well, I can't say I ever felt I pushed them in. I mean, I think when I began to write about women in the beginning, those were really, that was not so much a political view as it was a political concern. That is to say, when you write, you really what you do is you illuminate what's hidden, and that's a political act. So if I did, and I hope I did, illuminate the lives of women, of the women I knew who were alone with kids and all that, that was a political act. So I illuminated them. They didn't happen to whatever their political positions were. That was another story. But that was, from the beginning, I consider political, so to speak. Now, as for all the other interests of the women, in the way that it's a natural part of their lives, I certainly want it in there. I I uh, I am interested, as I said, in certain events, and then certain directions in the world, trends, and I am fearful for the world, and of course that has to get into it. You can't. It's not a question of want. It's there. You don't want, or you do want everything. There isn't anyone who writes a novel or a story that isn't political one way or another.
Grace Paley speaking with Terry Gross in 1985. The author, poet, and activist died this week at the age of 84. Coming up, film critic David Edelstein on The Nanny Diaries. This is Fresh Air. The Nanny Diaries is a new film based on the best-selling book. It stars Laura Linney as the composite character Mrs. X and Scarlett Johansson as Nanny. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
I've heard the juiciest stories from nannies who have plenty of time on the playground to trade intimate details with other nannies. That's why caregivers of celebrities' kids sign non-disclosure agreements. Still, Britney's disgruntled nannies are everywhere. Madonna was able to halt publication of her English nanny's tell-all, but the proposal got out, and let me tell you, it was irresistibly vicious. Emma McLaughlin and Nicola Krause's best-selling novel / Romana Clay, The Nanny Diaries, targeted the families of Upper East Side Manhattan finance bigwigs and lawyers, the absent dads, the smartly turned-out wives who don't work but are still so self-obsessed they have little time for their kids, and the children both spoiled and neglected. The book is contemptuous, but in its ghastly way, funny, with a vein of sympathy for the sad, angry little boy who no sooner forms a relationship with a nanny than she's fired for some minuscule offense. The writer-directors of the film are Sherry Springer Berman and Robert Pulcini, who came up with a marvelous ironic framing device for Harvey Pekar's American Splendor, and have another good one here. Scarlett Johansson plays Annie, an unaffected, working-class, recent college grad with an interest in anthropology. And the film begins in New York's Museum of Natural History, where Annie presents us with a series of fake dioramas featuring Manhattan families, placing their child-rearing rituals in a world historical context. It's a good, surreal start. Most American movies downplay issues of class and privilege. Unfortunately, the people we meet have no more depth or surprise than those diorama figures. After failing a Wall Street interview because she tells us she doesn't know who she is, Annie wanders through Central Park and finds herself set upon by young Grayer, and then his mom, Mrs. X, played by Laura Linney. With scarcely any time to orient herself, Annie, hereafter known as Nanny, finds herself sleeping in a cramped back bedroom in a sumptuous apartment and trying to raise a child almost on her own. Her mom, a nurse played by Donna Murphy, would be devastated to know her daughter is working as a domestic instead of on Wall Street. So in phone calls home, Annie tells Whoppers.
How are you, honey? How's the job? How's the apartment?
God, everything is just perfect.
I mean, the job is a dream.
And the apartment is just incredible.
Yeah?
And
my roommate could not be nicer.
Nanny, in the morning, I need you to stop at Tiffany's and pick up Mr. X's watch.
Then I need you to Xerox some recommendation letters for Grayer's collegiate application.
Also, I was thinking we should introduce French food into his diet. It might enhance his study of the language. So tomorrow night, why don't you make him Coquille Saint-Jacques for dinner, Dry cleaning.
Who was that, your roommate?
I have to go. I have some work stuff to take care of.
Laura Linney is the best thing in The Nanny Diaries, her face a tight mask under which you catch glimpses of the frightened human being. In some ways, though, she kills the comedy. The poor woman is so obviously suffering. Scarlett Johansson isn't a comedian either. She's funny when she uses her drugged sexiness to convey lazy entitlement, as in Ghost World. But adorably clumsy and eager to please, that's a stretch. As Mr. X, the myopic horn dog mergers and acquisitions tycoon, a strawberry blonde Paul Giamatti seems just as checked out as his character. Alicia Keys is wasted as the sassy sidekick, a tired device. And Chris Evans is the rich guy in the X's building, whom Annie calls the Harvard hottie, and whose insipid decency allows Annie to reject Upper East Side values, but potentially marry into the world anyway. It's possible that the filmmakers are too humanistic for their material. They can't get past the exploitation of the help and the neglect of a child, which is fine, admirable, but the balance is off. The Nanny Diaries is too shallow and unsurprising to be good social criticism, and too grimly unfunny to be a good satirical chick flick.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Podcasts of the show are available at our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from MGM, presenting Death at a Funeral, a comedy about romance, scandal, and mystery, from Frank Oz, the director of Bowfinger, in theaters now. From Anne and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development, cityyear.org. And from the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at WKKF.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Pulitzer Prize-winning photojournalist Paul Watson. He shot the iconic photo of an American airman whose Black Hawk had been shot down over the streets of Mogadishu in Somalia and whose corpse was being desecrated by an angry mob. His new memoir is Where War Lives. Join us for the next Fresh Air.